continuing with John Bolton on 15 March 78. The reason that so few identifications were made on the original 3C survey, for instance, Dewhurst was at Caltech at that time, as I'm sure you remember, was simply because of these very large effective error boxes, despite the low formal errors in positions.
But of course, Dewhurst did get a few identifications.
He got a few, yes, but a very low percentage of the overall catalog. Then what was made of this 16th magnitude star? This is 1960, I believe.
It was initially very hard to talk anybody into doing anything about it.
Even to look at the spectrum, you mean?
Yes. And Rudolf Minkowski had retired, of course, then. It was his last run on which he got a redshift of 295. And actually, Jesse Greenstein was the person that we said, Jesse, you've got to go and do something about this or else. And Jesse did. He attempted to. It's actually the first time he'd ever been in the prime focus cage.
I see.
And unfortunately, he was clouded out. And so it was Alan Sandage that Jesse... Alan was a lot more junior than he was now. He was told by Jesse to get a spectrum of this thing, you see. And of course, nobody could recognize the spectrum. And everybody, well, I mean, we had the idea when it was found was that, here was the start of something which ended up, the start of something optically. I mean, the general idea when we got it was that here is something very, very distant. That it's the bright flash in a galaxy which ultimately leads to the standard wide double radio source. But of course at that time, nobody had any knowledge of what the ultraviolet spectrum of anything looked like. Rockets hadn't flown, and
this flash business, of course, is just a bit of speculation.
Yeah, it's pure, those days. Pure speculation. Yeah, right. Yes, that this was the flash. This was the we saw this optical. We were seeing the optical phenomenon.
And a few million years later, maybe the radio lobes would be there.
That's right.
Yeah.
And. Well, a large number of people attempted to solve the spectrum. I indeed did get the right answer for the redshift of 3C48, and I had forgotten until quite some years later when Fred Hoyle reminded me that he'd come into my office 1 month's time, and Fred used to spend 3 months each year at Caltech, and I'd said to him, well, either the redshift of this object is 0.36 or I don't know what it is. And indeed, I had the line identification right, but the wavelength fit was not very good. And of course, nowadays one just doesn't worry because you know that the emission lines in quasars are chopped up on one side of its permitted line, they're chopped up by absorption lines and forbidden lines.
Yeah, but you had to be very conservative about any such thing.
Yeah, we had to be very conservative, but in fact, certainly Matthews and I were convinced that it was something, of superluminosity. But of course, until the later stage of 273 at Parkes, people were starting to, Jesse Greenstein and Martin Schmidt had written a paper to explain how a star could produce these lines at these wavelengths.
Right.
The idea had been dropped, of course. I think there were about four or five others found with peculiar emission line spectra or no emission lines at all in the Caltech search. So the reason we never got 3C273, I mean, it would have been so much easier if we'd identified 3C273 at that time, because its spectrum is very obvious. Here's the hydrogen line staring you in the face. But of course, 3C273 has the same right ascension as M87. And M87 was observed every day with the interferometer. It was one of the fundamental calibrators, and so 3C273 is.
I hadn't heard that story. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's true. And later when we come to the Parkes dish, the position I set on the telescope for the lunar occultation of 3C273 was the position that came out of the occultation.
But why couldn't you observe off the meridian?
We tried to catch everything. We tried to catch one observation on the meridian always, and I suppose we could have done, but I mean M87 was
right,
the one. M87 was the fundamental thing. Where is the what's happening to the drift in our cables and that kind of thing?
Yeah. So you always caught it at transit.
We always caught M87.
And 3C273 was just another 3C source, which. Or is that true? I mean, there was no particular need to.
No. Just another 3C source.
Although, well, no, but it was. I'm confused now. Was it one of the Federal Bank very low, very small sources?
No.
Was not. Okay.
In any case, its declination was rather low and would have been a challenge to get its declination with the Caltech interferometer at that stage.
You were concentrating on the ones you could do better.
Yes.
But was there any published record of this toying around with such horrendous redshifts for that day and age?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, I'd never heard that anyone had really ever come up with a possible number, you know, before Martin Schmidt's.
No, I mean, the lines one could see in 3C273 were 3C48 for the magnesium 2, neon 5, and oxygen 3727.
No hydrogen lines?
No.
Yeah.
In fact, I think it was only 3727 and magnesium 2, the two lines. And 3727, of course, is forbidden. Magnesium 2 is not.
Yes,
From.
Well, let's see, just looking at the other papers through 1960, in which you're a co-author, let's see if there's anything we haven't discussed. You actually published a paper with Radhakrishnan on H1 absorption on the Owens Valley interferometer in 1960. Where did the idea of doing interferometric H1 absorption come from? Were you thinking these must be small clouds,
No. I mean, the interferometer was always envisaged to do H1 absorption measurements. Simply because one isolates the source. I mean, you avoid the difficulty of having to subtract an average emission profile of the surrounding region from the absorption profile, and in fact, the first observations which Radhakrishnan and I ever did gave totally different profiles from the from the single dish profiles, which said, you know, the structure between the emission structure in between our fringe size and our single dish size. In fact, of course, Rad followed this up in later stages very successfully using the interferometer
here in Parkes. So you're saying that as soon as NRL showed that there were these narrow absorption lines, that it was clear to you that this would be a good thing to do with an interferometer?
Well, the point was that one could only observe sources which gave you antenna temperatures which were at least in the tens of degrees, because you faced the emission background of 100 degrees. If you're ever going to work large numbers of sources and determine what the sort of interstellar background looks like in many directions, and wanted to work on sources which had antenna temperatures of 2 or 3 degrees, then you had to go to interferometry.
Were you thinking in these early, you know, 57, 58, were you thinking that indeed you might come up with a different kind of gas, the sort of thing that eventually happens, that you might be finding a different component of the interstellar medium?
Oh, yes. Well, I was convinced of that in 55,
that these clouds were...
That there must be hot and cold clouds. In fact, Rad and I, Rad published it in PASP, did find self-absorption at one stage, which coincided with a dark lane in the... We found this near IC443.
I see.
We actually found self-absorption in the emission background. But that was before we had the interferometer going. I mean, this is the very now very familiar cool clouds of molecules.
Yeah, well, but then, of course, it was not a standard concept at all. Well, this is all the publications I have through 1960. Before we come down to the Parkes antenna, are there any other aspects of Caltech that should be covered?
Well, Caltech never sort of continued with the very successful run we had in the 59-60 era.
You mean what, after you left?
Yes. Caltech is principally to blame for that. I mean, we had a very keen crew of graduate students, people like Ken Kellerman, Barry Clark, and Bob Wilson, and so on. But unfortunately, of course, Caltech would not appoint another director.
Was this basically financial
reasons? No, I don't know why. I really don't know why. Minkowski and Bader had gone.
Right.
And so the pressure from optical side was lacking. Caltech wanted somebody with a big name. I made two suggestions as to who should be the next director, one of whom was finally appointed, Marshall Cohen. Now, if Marshall had been appointed when I was, as soon as I left, I think it would have gone on from strength to strength. The other was Bill Erickson, who had worked with us to quite some degree. But you see, it left Caltech with nobody who could, say, argue with people like Robert Barker and Willie Fowler and Mike Bowen and so on. Gordon Stanley, very reluctantly, he certainly never wanted. I mean, his interest was purely in the technical side.
Right.
And it unfortunately died to some extent and still continues.
The thing that sort of interests me is that with these two movable antennas, you had the possibility to do what is now called Earth rotation synthesis or supersynthesis. Did this ever occur to you people in those days, or were you just so fixed on just getting sizes and positions that was sort of outside your realm?
Well, we used the two antennas as for very flexible single experiments. In a way, we did synthesis. I mean, Moffat's work on angular sizes is synthesis.
Right.
At that stage, we had one or 200 sources on which we could get detailed information. And
you wanted to do that first before you spent a lot of
time picking up
one single map on some.
That's right. Yes. And the other problem, of course, is the tremendous effort one has to put in on the computing side.
Although at Caltech, I would think if anywhere, there must have been some good computers coming along, and by the late 50s.
Yes, this is true. But you've got to go to computer data recording.
And you've got to develop all the
everything
software.
Everything like that. But yeah. I mean, we were by no means we were doing the easy experiments.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then Taffy Bowen offered you the. What was the official title of the position? The directorship of the Parkes Observatory? Mm. And you came down here in what year?
The end of 1960, Christmas 1960.
So that was a year before the dish went on the air.
It was before it was built.
Even before it was built?
Yeah.
Oh, was it late 62 that went on the air?
No, late 61.
Oh, it was built that fast?
Yes, just the tower was here when I came down.
Okay. And what was the program that you were envisaging for the dish?
Well, one of the things we could not do very successfully at Caltech was to employ the whole of the radio spectrum. And this is one thing, I mean, we didn't have the collecting power at very short wavelengths. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the resolving power at long wavelengths. I mean, Caltech was ideally suited to, say, around the 21 centimeter
right.
region. Well, one could see the collecting area being useful as shorter wavelengths as 10 centimeters, and the resolving power useful at wavelengths as long as, say, 70 centimeters.
Did you have enough staff to maintain such a wide stable of receivers also at Caltech?
Well,
if you
I mean, Caltech's primary resolving power and collecting area. The collecting area, you see, sensitivity to the receivers have changed very radically, and so one always has to look at the epoch.
Yeah, okay.
We were struggling past 21 centimeters, even though we sort of got experimental traveling wave tubes at 10 centimeters, and towards the end, the maser looked possible. But we really had to go to, say, 1 gigahertz to get adequate resolving power in our single dish. So what I principally saw in Parkes was the possibility of using a very much bigger bite of the radio spectrum.
I see.
And of course, in my... John Chemins and I found that one could in fact distinguish what one was looking at through the spectrum. I mean, there's a 99% chance of a flat spectrum object as a quasar and ditto, so one can do some sort of blind astronomy.
But that wasn't clear when you came down here in 1960. Or were you thinking that maybe you would...
Well, we didn't have, at that time, we didn't know what we could do if we used the whole spectrum.
Right.
Parkes hadn't offered me the addition.
It just hadn't been investigated.
Yes. In any case, I was committed to come back here quite some time before I did come back. I mean, Taffy was over for the dedication of the 90 footers and was very impressed with them and everything like that. And he said, "I suppose you're here for life." And I said, "No, I'd like to come back when things running properly." And he said, "Well, 2 10-foot job is yours when you want it." And of course, the pressure came on me a little early. We were really having a very successful time at Caltech when Taffy began to make noises that I should be here when the dish starts to go up. And,
I see.
And so on. So I really left.
So you would have preferred a little bit better timing.
I would have preferred another year at Caltech if it happened, but there were other things which. You know, our kids were getting to the stage where they were leaving school and that kind of thing. So, from a family point of view, it was better to make a change then.
So, the Parkes dish itself, I've talked to people like Harry Minnett and so forth. It seems that the construction went very smoothly and very fast, even finished before expected, which is almost unheard of once it had started being built. Your program then was to, from what you said, to look at the spectra of...
I don't think the directorship of Parkes was very different from the directorship of the Owens Valley. The directorship of the Owens Valley was, in fact, building the equipment and directing its research program.
Yes.
In the case of the Parkes telescope, it was principally getting the antenna going.
For other people
to use. And I certainly had no expectations of doing anything personally with it. My main job was to get it built and then to get it operating. And of course, when I came back, we still had the many small groups. And really, there were very few people who even conceived of using the Parkes dish, you see. It was something that's quite unreal to most of the lab. But of course, many people from radiophysics had gone overseas. Roberts was with me at Caltech, he came back with me, and Radhakrishnan and Morris came to Australia from Caltech. Mathewson came back from Dodrell Bank, Brian Robinson came back from Leiden, and so on.
Right.
But, I mean, and the people who were really wanting to use the dish, well, Frank Kerr, Don Mathewson, who had just arrived back, you see.
Right.
Frank Gardner was the only sort of local radio physics person who, in addition to Frank Kerr, who had ambitions on the 210.
Just because people were not oriented towards large...
They were not oriented toward. They didn't think of it. And they all had their own little field stations. And, no provision was made for even operating funds for the 210. And I went around the second year after it had been built, visiting closing field stations to get some operating funds. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you didn't have to employ the man who cut the grass and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We're very short of funds.
So it really was a very big change in style, the whole way the lab
operated.
Yes,
very big change in style.
And which obviously makes for various adjustments.
But then, of course, we had a number of almost immediate successes. And that sort of gradually changed the whole pattern. People who didn't want anything to do with it either had a bad time or drifted away. So even Pawsey quit. Unfortunately, of course, he died shortly afterwards.
But that was before the dish went on the air, was it not?
It was round about that time. I think Pawsey made up his mind. Well, he went to investigate Green Bank about 6 months through construction.
Yes, right.
And then he fell ill and was out of action for, oh, perhaps another 9 months. But he was in on the Faraday rotation work. And,
the planning for it?
No, I mean, he saw the results of that. And,
I see.
And saw the, I forget whether he, yes, he saw the 3C273 occultation results. But, I mean, he was an invalid by then.
Yeah.
I would go to his home and tell him what was going on.
But he seemed to be showing more enthusiasm for
these
sort of things.
Yeah. Yes, one of the things that I very greatly regret, actually, was I had built the polarization equipment for this dish. As I said, it was modeled on the Caltech business, and Joe had wanted to use it on a much smaller dish to see if he could find polarization in the general background,
mm-hmm.
and I refused to let him have the equipment. And of course the Dutch got there first.
Mm-hmm.
He could have found it if I'd only let him have the polarization equipment. But
what sort of frequency was this?
This was a 400.
Hmm.
And well, the reason I refused to let him have it was that I spent a lot of effort in designing it, making it work and everything like that, and it would have had to have been chopped up and mounted on something, and by that time we were well into this construction, and it was one of the things I had.
Was it a small dish you were thinking of?
Yes, a small dish, 15-foot dish, which he was done.
Interesting. Well, I think the 3C273 story would be a fitting end to the scientific side of things anyway. Could you tell me about how that came about, as you saw it from the director's point of view? I don't believe you yourself were involved.
Yes, I was very involved.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I directed the experiment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Cyril Hazard came out to Australia to work with the Sydney University group. About the same time I came back to 210, and I'd known Cyril for a long time. And Cyril came into radiophysics one day with the results of a lunar occultation, the only really successful lunar occultation that he'd done with the Dogger Bank telescope. Many people, of course, have had the idea of doing lunar occultations. We tried one at Caltech with the interferometer, actually. Prior to Cyril. And Cyril showed me the results of this, and even though he didn't get an identification, it's still one of the unidentified 3C sources. The potential of the technique was very, very obvious, and I invited Cyril to make use of the 210 foot.
Mm-hmm. What was the technical difficulties, for instance, at Caltech? You say you tried one.
Well, we tried it on a 3C source, so we which was in the wrong position.
Oh, you didn't? Okay. You didn't try it on ones that you got good positions for?
Well, I mean, this was one which we hadn't positioned. It was a prediction from the Nautical Almanac office. We had to cut out the moon with the interferometer, and we did that successfully. But when we came to make the actual observation, we got no result, and we later found in hunting around the 3C source wasn't occulted.
I see.
But, I mean, we got this prediction list. Oh, that's going to be occulted, yes. A week only a week to plan and
right.
get the dishes in the right place to cut the moon out. And,
so it was just sort of a quickly done thing.
Yeah, it was down in a level of sensitivity which we couldn't easily see the source directly, but could easily see it in lunar rotation. Of course, 3C273 was one of the sources to which occultation was predicted for, I think, was it 62? Yes, 62. And John Shimmons was assigned to help Cyril because it required some tricky dish driving, and John was responsible for the telescope drive system. So then Brian Mackey was assigned because Brian and I had built the two receivers which were going to be used.
You were tracking the limb of the moon?
Yes. No, the decision was made to track the source.
So why was there tricky dish driving?
There was tricky dish driving because all these occultations occur outside the limits of the telescope.
Oh. Below the
minimum zenith
angle, elevation.
And I think in the first one we actually had to use offset feeds for it. And the first occultation was bungled. They didn't get anything.
Of 273?
Yes. Yeah. And so I decided the second one, which was the most promising one, because we looked as though we could get both the immersion and the emersion.
I see.
I took charge of the dish and, I took the precautions which we later took for the Apollo missions and so on, you know, of doubling everything, practice runs and two clocks, two recorders. I forget what happened. I think the, you know, silly thing like the ink running out on the recorder and blown the first one. And so it was a sort of military operation.
Yeah, or like an eclipse. Or...
You know, interference, the site was closed, the roads were blocked.
Oh, really? That way?
The whole telescope and everything was closed for 3 days beforehand, so that nothing went wrong. We were prepared to...
Why did you attach so much importance to it?
I didn't know. Well, I suppose it irritated me that it had been missed, you see. It wasn't going to be missed again.
Okay.
And of course, it was very successful. And I suppose the extreme length to which I went was that Cyril Hazard and I flew back to Sydney on different aeroplanes. With the record.
But only one person had the record. What did you mean?
No, everything was duplicated.
Oh, I see. You had two strip charts and everything.
I think four strip charts. And clocks were duplicated. Everything was duplicated.
I thought you meant you just had backups in case the one failed, but you ran them all too.
Mm.
So that you must have had some unconscious premonition about that this was going to be important.
Well, you see, Rudolf was here, Rudolf Minkowski, and Rudolf had sent to Caltech for his plates of the region of 3C273.
To date, there was only one quasi-stellar, or had there a couple?
No, there'd be half a dozen.
But
see, we didn't know what 3C273 was.
Right.
But the position which we determined with this dish prior to the occultation said on Rudolf's plates, it's either that star or it's that jet. We couldn't determine
either
which.
Either way, it was very interesting.
Mm.
Yeah.
So it was very interesting. And of course, it turned out to be both.
Yeah, yeah. What sort of accuracy did that result in the position of the source?
About a second of arc. But you see, the position we set on the dials for the occultation was the position which the occultation said it was.
Oh, is that how it turned out, actually?
Yeah.
I see. But...
we set midway between the jets.
So you didn't change the position, you just changed the... the error bars.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it said, the occultation gave us the structure,
right,
which said it's that star and that jet.
Well, let me just go back and ask a couple more general questions. First of all, you mentioned this trip in 1950 where you visited Leiden and other places. I was wondering if you could just give me some idea of your impressions about the efforts that were going on at other places and or the reception you got as one of these.
Well, as I said prior to that, I had corresponded with Ort and Lindbergh and with Minkowski and Bader. I went to England to start with, and Westvogel actually went to Oxford at that time. And I made Oxford my base, and from there Westvogel and I made forays into various astronomical centres of Europe. At Leiden we spent quite a long time. We lectured at Leiden that summer. We went to Kiel. We went to Paris and became great friends with the French early group, Denise, Blum, Steinberg, and so on. We went to Sweden, saw Lindblad and Rydbeck, Gothenburg. We went to Denmark and saw Strongren, and he's been a close friend for many years also.
But now, that seems rather odd to me. Strongren was a classical stellar astronomer.
Yes.
And why would you go to see him?
Well, I think I was interested in knowing these people. I had read their papers and so on. Where else did I go? We went to the IRSA meeting in Zurich. In Cambridge, of course, there was all this problem with Ryle, but I got to know Fred Hoyle and Herman Bondi and Ray Littleton very well.
You say all these problems, what were they?
Well, of course, if we go back and take to where I, we talked about the scintillations.
Oh, that's right, that's right.
I had corresponded with Ryle and so on.
He hadn't told you at all about...
Hadn't told me about it at all. And I wrote to him...
You were saying you were talking with Ryle about what?
Yes, and when I got to England, I went around various places, and finally I wrote to Ryle and said I was hoping to come over for the May week, or a couple of weeks around the May week, which is sort of end of term and boating activities and lots of celebrations at Cambridge. And I got a reply back from Bragg, who was then director of the Cavendish, saying that, he'd heard of my... Ryle had told him of my visit, and I should understand that Ryle's group were, doing research which was in the forefront of world work, and the group was pestered by hundreds of visitors. And,
incredible!
And he was sorry I couldn't come.
Amazing, from Bragg.
Yeah.
So you didn't?
I guess I went for a month.
At Cambridge?
Yeah. Yeah, so it was a very big stink over it. And of course it got all around the university and everything like that. And I was made very welcome by anybody who didn't like Ryle. And
so you mean you just showed up in the hallways and started talking to people?
Yes, well, I hadn't actually met Fred Hoyle except for one occasion during the war, but I'd had quite a bit of correspondence with Fred on various things. The attitude of the Cambridge Mathematical Group and so on, totally different to that of Ryle. And,
right. But what I'm getting at is, did you visit the Radio Astronomy Group?
Oh, yes, I did. Yeah. Yes.
But
as Ryle realized afterwards, he made a terrible mistake and
went
and saw George Batchelor, who was the sort of dean of Australians in Cambridge, to sort of back him up that he'd done the right thing, and George told him he certainly hadn't. And
I see, so in this way contact was made, although it was undoubtedly strained.
And of course I met Graham Smith and John Shepard, and people have been friends for years out of that group, but Ryle's a very unfortunate person. I remember one incident that I think I was having dinner with Fred Hoyle in John's, and there was discussion at the table about it, and a professor of anatomy, whose name when I was a student was Sex Harris, because he always began his first year lectures by writing sex in 6-foot-high letters across the board. He pricked up his ears at this conversation and looked across the table and said, "Do you know what's wrong with Ryle?" And I said, "No." He said, "His mother was named the Third Dutch and his father was a medical failure, accused everybody else of plagiarism."
At Leiden, I was thinking you must have discussed at great length models of the galactic radiation, because Westerhout and Oort were working on this. I guess they had finished just publishing their paper at this time.
Yes, we'd done, Westfeld and I had done very similar things to...
were there any points of disagreement, or did you, were you pretty much...
You were asking earlier why I went to see Strömgren.
Yes.
Well, I mean, one of the things that Westfeld and I realized was the importance of free-free absorption in modeling at the wavelengths we were interested in.
Right.
And nowhere in the literature could we get a really good handle on the interstellar electron density.
I see.
And we corresponded with Strömgren, and we corresponded with Lyman Spitzer, who at the time had, well, it was both the density and temperature we wanted.
Right.
And Lyman had written two papers. One was the things, all the phenomena which heat up the interstellar material, and the other one was all the phenomena which cool the interstellar material. And paper 3 was promised, and actually it was never written. It was paper 3, how you put it all together and get the temperature and density of interstellar. So that was one of the reasons for talking stronger.
And what was the conclusion that... So you were at 100 megahertz now.
We were at 100 megahertz.
And what did you conclude as to...
Well, I think our conclusions... were probably that it didn't matter that much, except at very, very low latitudes.
And with such a broad beam, dilute the effect.
But unfortunately in concentration of the plane it is an important effect. We were looking to develop our work by modeling with both a radial and a Z distribution of absorption. We never got around to that, and we just played with the idea. Where else did I go in Europe?
But let me just go back. Were there any major differences in outlook as to the source of the galactic radiation between your model and Oort's ideas at that time?
Well, no. I mean, we both attributed it to essentially an unknown origin. Kevin and I called them radio stars, but in our, that was just a volume emissivity element, except one couldn't be quite certain. As I said later, we came to the conclusion that the density was that of the electrons. It wasn't stars. To a certain extent, the teaching at Leiden was largely based on a lot of the work that Kevin and I had done. The spherical integration methods, the concept of temperature and so on, these were really devoured at Leiden and formed large parts of the... what we'd put into a paper was expanded out to three lectures by the Leiden people. I think we were there for something like a month, and 2 or 3 days a week, Oort would call us in for and we'd just sit down and have a 2 or 3 hour discussion with the Oort and Van der Holt and Westerhout and I. Oort was a great seeker after the truth.
Well, so long as he liked the idea of your truth. You visited Jodrell Bank, I said.
Yes, I spent quite a lot of time at Jodrell Bank. In fact, Hanbury Brown, one of the things I was given was the Hanbury Brown Twist notebook on the correlation, amplitude correlation thermometer, to look through it and see if I could find mistakes in mathematics and so on. In those days it was terribly complex, and you know, you just got lost in the mathematics and you had no physical insight, and all I could do was just plod through it and say, well, I can't find any mistakes, and I don't understand how it works, mm-hmm. and so on. And so later that year, I went back to the Oracle Bank, and of course, they'd done the solar angular diameter by using two overlapping antennas.
Yeah.
And I saw Hay at that stage. He was still in Surrey.
Was the 218-foot hole in the ground
yes.
built when you were there?
Yeah, that yeah. was there.
This must have made some impression, obviously,
yes.
in terms of later building one yourself. Right. Yeah.
And then I went to Canada, where I saw Covington's work, mm-hmm. and then to Cornell, or Toronto, and Cornell, and Harvard, and Yerkes Observatory, which is solely optical.
Now, at Harvard, you saw for yourself, you and Purcell,
oh, yes,
working
yes,
on...
Sure.
This yeah. was 50 now.
This was 50.
So this was a year before mm-hmm. it was detected.
Yeah. And... Well, of course, I'd seen the Dutch work going on with the receiver.
Oh, that's true, also.
Like that. And it, of course, was destroyed in a fire. They should have won. The fire destroyed the initial receiver. And then I traveled across country, spent quite a long time in Pasadena, and finally Berkeley.
Where?
And, of course, I lectured in all these places. And you know, many people said afterwards, you know, the thing that really changed history was your visit to Copenhagen and, or Gothenburg.
In what sense?
In the sense that radio astronomy became a reality to them.
I see. Places that hadn't had the contact before.
Places that hadn't had the contact. They actually met people with mm-hmm. slides and records and ideas and
yeah.
that kind of thing. I see, radio astronomers didn't get around.
They didn't go to
they didn't
places.
Go to... I was yeah. the first person you were,
which is perhaps having to do with your reading 20 years of Apjay and so forth. There were, you obviously had more of an orientation this way than...
Yes.
In fact, a question I want to ask you is in the late 40s, if someone asked you, what do you do, you know, at a cocktail party or something, what did you say?
Well, by 1949, I was saying I'm a radio astronomer.
I think
I was the first person mm-hmm. to use those words. In fact, I gave a lecture at the Royal Society of New South Wales. The title was Radio Astronomy, and this was the first time I'd used it myself. Mm-hmm.
And before that, you would have said what?
Oh, before that, nobody asked me. I mean, I worked out on Dover Heights, and it was very difficult to say what I was doing. I had some contract with an astronomer, particularly Clay Allen, C.W.
Yeah.
Allen.
I talked to him a couple of days ago. But indeed, that's very early for someone to be calling himself a radio astronomer.
Mm.
I don't think I've ever heard it. Had anyone else say?
Well, I made radio astronomy the title of this lecture.
Yeah,
see.
Yeah. Well, but it seems to me that was a discipline called radio astronomy starting around 48 or 49, and everyone sort of understood this, but people did not call themselves radio astronomers until really the sort of late 50s in general. They were always thinking of themselves as radio physicist or an engineer or a physicist.
Oh, no, I was appointed professor of radio astronomy at Caltech.
Yes.
It was a radio astronomy department right from the beginning.
But that's 55 now.
Yes. Well, you said the late 50s.
Yeah, okay, mid-50s.
Yes.
And Ryle also got a chair in radio astronomy in 58 or so.
Yes.
I guess Lovell a bit earlier.
Yes.
So, I mean, that was when it was.
Mm.
Another.
No, I think the Manchester people always considered themselves radio astronomers.
I may not have asked that question at all. I can't remember now.
I mean, they call those things telescopes.
Yes, that's true.
Mm.
And I know Lovell does have an article in 48 or so where he talks about radio astronomy also. Another general question. Over the years, and especially now up to the Parkes dish, what, in your opinion, are the key ingredients to the success that radio physics has had in terms of being one of the three or four leading places?